Charles Hugh Smith from the blog of twominds.com returns to the show with some very interesting recent topicality that I know our listeners are going to like. Welcome back, Charles Hugh Smith.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, it's great to have you back and, you know, give people an overview.
Well, Chris, I guess we can start by saying that I think I received two educations at once because I worked my way through college working for construction firms, you know, for remodelers and builders. So I learned quite a bit about the trades while I was getting a degree in philosophy. But the one good thing about philosophy is it does teach you to read things critically and to try to parse out, like, what are the key ideas here and what are the key assumptions being made about those ideas. And so that served me well when I moved from building and remodeling into writing about housing and then the housing bubble and then all the financial aspects that I learned about, you know, as to how the housing bubble in the 2000s came about. And then that kind of led naturally into, well, where are all these economic and social trends taking us as we go forward? You know, like, we didn't really solve all the causes of that bubble, and now, you know, a lot of us feel that we're in another series of bubbles. So it's a fascinating time to be alive, what with the internet, and share a lot more ideas than we used to back when you had a small number of gatekeepers, you know, that there were three TV networks and a handful of major newspapers. And so now it's a bit more of a free-for-all, but we have a broader range of ideas out there as a result.
I'd like to talk about the Dow Jones. As you know, last week, the big milestone, 20,000. You know, it seems like just about a decade or two ago, we were around 10,000 or 11,000 on the Dow. So some folks are questioning, is this a debt-based rally that has occurred in the U.S. equities markets, the financial institutions, widespread access from our central banks of a massive, you could even say trillions, certainly billions of dollars, where they could buy up, you know, their own shares, many of these institutions and corporations, using very inexpensive debt. The term here, of course, our listeners know, are buybacks. You know, these debt levels might have peaked, that maybe we've just taken on about as much debt as possible. You know, give us an idea of the implications of all of this debt for the U.S. economy.
Well, that's a big topic. The chart that you're referring to, maybe we can start with that, which is a chart from Societe Generale, the French bank, which shows corporate buybacks and the amount of change in corporate debt. And, of course, we're not surprised to see that as corporations borrow a lot of money, they increase their buybacks of their own shares, which then boosts the value of the remaining shares. And it's a classic way of extracting wealth from the company. If you're a manager or, you know, in the high ownership, because as your shares go up in value, it's based not on generating more revenues or more profits. It's simply based on reducing the number of shares by increasing the corporation's debt. So, and of course, debt does have a cost. It's called interest. And even at low rates, eventually, you know, it takes away, it subtracts from your revenues because you've got to pay the interest on the debt you borrowed to boost your own personal wealth. So, and it does look like corporate debt and buybacks have topped out, and at very similar levels to the 2007-2008 peak, which, of course, was followed by the global financial crisis. And so that's one aspect of debt, right, corporate debt. And, of course, we know that, to the best of our knowledge, there's enormous levels of corporate debt in Europe and Japan and in China as well. So this is not just isolated to the United States, right? I mean, it's a global phenomenon. We also know that sovereign debt's soaring, right, because all these every government is funding its programs and expenses by selling more bonds, i.e., you know, borrowing more money from future taxpayers. And then we've got personal debt, right, and shadow banking debt. And so, yeah, it does raise a key question, Chris, which is, what is the collateral underlying all this expansion of debt? In other words, what is it based on? And in theory, It's based in on the corporate level on higher earnings and higher profits, right? In other words, that's your income stream is expanding, and therefore you can afford more debt. Similar to a household that sees real earnings expansion, you know, they're making more money every year than they can afford to borrow more money. But we're not so sure that real net earnings are in fact rising either for households or corporations. And so the suspicion is that this debt is actually being expanding a narrowing base of actual collateral, and whether that's real tangible collateral such as precious metals or productive, you know, land or real estate, or if it's the collateral of earnings. And in both cases, we're many of us are suspicious of this, that there's an expansion of collateral to match the expansion of debt.
I'd like to point out some interesting facts here. I mean, give folks some perspective. David Stockman, I think, does a fantastic job showing how the Dow has been fueled, you know, our Dow Jones Industrials 20 years or so, actually it's closer to 30 years, on just how much debt fueled this astounding advance. And it's nearly one-to-one ratio. If you take a look at his numbers, he shows the Dow Jones is up roughly 20-fold and U.S. debt is up to about 22-fold. So you've got a very close correlation there. I know our listeners know by now we have about $20 trillion in national debt, which has doubled over the last several years. Back to 1981. Ronald Reagan is in office. We have less than $1 trillion, about $951 billion in total national debt. This is hard to even wrap one's mind around. We haven't even used the T word yet. We're back on B. And then, boom, we start to skyrocket in through the Bill Clinton years into the end of the 1990s. And then it really takes off. We're approaching exponential growth here in debt. Some folks are saying that the current administration will have to bump things up to as high as, let's say, $30 trillion in order to maintain the status quo that we've enjoyed, I guess, some people, maybe a very slight fraction of our populace has enjoyed. Do you care to give people more perspective on the risks here associated with this debt?
It's an excellent question, and I have a chart here on the blog today of the global bond market, which, of course, is just another term for the debt market, right? Because you sell a bond and that becomes a debt. And so kind of mirroring the statistics you mentioned from David Stockman's site, this chart shows that global bond market, the emerging markets, the developed markets other than the U.S., like Europe and Japan, and then the United States, there was about $10 trillion in outstanding bonds. I mean, private, public, everything. 1990. And now it's pushing $100 trillion. It's almost to 100. So it's gone up tenfold since the early 90s. So that, you know, we have to wonder, did the collateral and the income stream rise tenfold to support that? I think one of the dangers that I'm looking at is, where is the revenue and profit stream coming from that's going to be able to, you know, service this enormous increase in debt? And I tend to think that the global corporations, that they've shown strong revenue and profit growth over the last, you know, 15 years, and now we see, if you look at corporate profits, you see that they're flatlined, they're sort of stagnant, they're down. Or maybe they're up a tiny bit, but they're no longer climbing in a straight line like they were all through the 90s and much of the 21st century. And so we can ask, well, why is that? And of course, we all know the answers. You know, globalization is already, everybody that was that made a fortune by moving the factory from the U.S. overseas, that's all been done. Now labor costs are rising in China and the rest of Southeast Asia. That old debt that used to be, say, at 7 or 8% and then refinancing it at, you know, a much lower rate, 2, 3, 4%, that's all been done, right? And now we see global interest rates clicking higher along with global inflation. So it's, as we put these together, we go, everybody's borrowing more money, but actual net income, both for households and for corporations, is stagnant. So that's a problem, right? I mean, if you're going to keep borrowing a lot of money and yet your income stream is stagnant or declining, then eventually you're going to reach a point where you can't service that debt. You can no longer make the payments. And then we get a global financial crisis. And where it's going to come from? Well, that's the question. And crises tend to not repeat themselves. In other words, if the crisis came from subprime mortgages in 2008, we're probably not going to get that same source of the crisis. It'll be somewhere else. You know, it'll come from another part of the global financial system that is just as fragile, just as over-leveraged as the subprime mortgage sector was in 2008.
You're essentially mirroring the comments of some of our guests here in the past, including Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, a top economist, Boston University. He has pointed out this nonsense of $20 trillion in debt. You really need to at least take that number, multiply it by 10. His numbers range anywhere from 200 trillion to 220 trillion in total national debt. And of course, it's just unsustainable. We're looking at debt that is growing at a phenomenal pace, far beyond our gross domestic product. That's where you start to get into trouble. And we can simplify it. If you have a household and you are taking on lines of credit and maxing out your credit cards and student loans, car loans, you name it, but your income is stagnant or even declining, give us an idea of the economic fallout we're facing.
Many of us who are considered rogue, or say, let's just call it unconventional economists or observers, we all know there's going to be a crunch time when this debt that's unpayable is going to be either written off, like it has to be written down, and the people holding that debt as an asset have to absorb the loss, or the money that we use, our currency, has to be depreciated so to such a degree that the debtors, both nations and households and companies, will be able to service the debt because they're using money that's lost. And of course, there aren't a lot of other tricks to deal with this. And so that's why many of us, we look ahead and we'll go, either you've got to accept, grasp the nettle. In other words, accept the reality that this debt's never going to be paid back and the debt has to be written off, which is what happens in bankruptcy, right? That say a household goes bankrupt, then it's basically an acceptance of everybody involved that the household can't pay this debt back, they can't make the interest payments, and so it's going to have to be renegotiated, and the bank or the lenders are going to have to absorb the loss. They're never going to get the money back. And this, of course, is painful, especially for people that own the debt, right, that thought that was an asset. Or you mess with your currency, which, as many of your guests have pointed out, this is one of the favorites throughout history, is for governments to devalue their currency as a way of keeping the illusion alive that the whole system is solvent. But it's actually insolvent, and so the losses are taken through the currency. But this is a disaster for national economies, and this is why most countries that try this end up collapsing, is you're taking away the purchasing power of everyone who holds your currency. And that includes your citizens, it includes overseas investors. It wipes out everybody instead of just wiping out the bad debt. And so I think the best way to clear, you know, a debt overhang or a debt that's unpayable or so-called bad debt is to come out of the pocket of the people who are directly owning of that debt. In other words, if the bank holds a bond or a mortgage that's not going to get paid, the bank has to accept the losses. And, of course, that's what should have happened in 2008 in the global financial crisis. But the banks had gained so much political power and had become so integral to the economy that the politicians were fearful of forcing the banks into insolvency. So they bailed them out. And so that creates a problem because we didn't get rid of the bad debt, and now it's become a systemic risk. And in other words, the risk has now been spread to all of us. Those of us that look at places like Venezuela, where they've heavily devalued their currency as the so-called solution, it's impoverished the whole nation. And that's a tragedy, but that's what you get if you don't deal with it up front.
But at the heart of it is a lack of understanding of inflation and the ramifications of tinkering with your currency in that way. And at last check, and by now it's probably gone even higher. This was several weeks ago. But, I mean, they had removed a couple of their bolivars out of circulation, and it seemed like the 20,000 bolivar. And, of course, we're also seeing currency issues in India. I mean, this is an enormous nation now, I mean, with essentially a billion plus. Essentially shut the entire economy down in this push to go digital. And there's a lot of talk that this could gain momentum, that this might just be the, the petri dish for the elite, for the powers that be, who wish to have total control over every transaction in an economy. If you're really being above board, you would never have any need for that outdated relic of the past, paper currency. That limits freedom. And so it looks great theoretically, but empirically, we run into some big issues when every single transaction is transparent.
My kind of approach is to look at it as a financial or aspect, but also as a cultural aspect. And so what we find is that the smaller Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, they're largely digital now. In other words, the people there don't have the same sense that cash is a protection against government abuse. And it kind of, I think, relates to the fact that these are small countries with, 5 or 6 million people in the case of Denmark, or 14 million in Sweden. I mean, basically a large U.S. city. And so they have a much higher level of trust in their social contract. In other words, they trust their government. Their governments tend to have very low levels of corruption. And so they can kind of get away with a digital by switching to digital, because it does save money. In other words, having to deal with cash as a store owner, it adds expense because you've got to deal with all this stuff. It creates a theft risk, where if you're just sliding debit cards, there's no cash for anybody to steal, and it's a quicker transaction. So there are some advantages to digital, only, but that's unique to those countries that with very high trust levels in there. Many of us fear the government because we largely controlled by private interests who are vested and self-serving. And so we are fearful that the government's not going to take action to protect the best interests of but that they'll take action to protect the elites who own the assets and political power. So that's why our trust level in our government and our social contract is much lower. And so if you look at Japan, cash is king in Japan. They would have a very severe social disorder if they tried to ban cash in Japan, because the Japanese just culturally are extremely attached to cash. And so those of us that live in countries where we feel our social contract with our government is fraying because of huge inequalities of wealth and power, then we're fearful of losing cash, total control by the government, which is itself controlled by vested interests. So that's kind of the chain I see, and that we're all for ending corruption, and we're all for reducing costs of transactions, but we would need to have higher level of trust in our government and in our social contract before we could let go of cash like the Scandinavians.
This is maybe an even more insidious problem, Gresham's Law. As money is debased, you start to find that things with value begin to disappear. Silver coins from circulation. 10, 20 years ago, any handful of coins from the local pharmacy, if you will, or from Walmart, Kmart, you could easily find a silver dime or silver quarter. Good luck today. They've been picked out of circulation for the most part. I see what appears to be, and I'm not the first to mention this, we've had guests on the show that have talked about this, an invisible net sort of encircling the whole nation, or even the world itself financially. We're seeing a transition away now from, of course, cash and bills, if you will, as well as plastic even, into this pseudo-digital world. If, those worthless, hollowed-out coins that we have that have no precious metals in them at all, maybe a little bit of copper sandwich, even they have more value. So you see Gresham's Law pushing a us further, I think, now into a digital realm. And that's where things could really get frightening, because if we entered a situation where the power was cut off, you know, a Katrina-like situation, but more widespread, or a banking holiday. Yes, they have happened. We've seen them on the East Coast during recent storms, tropical storms, and we've seen them in the Gulf of the United States following hurricanes. And I'd like your thoughts on just how might society react to the inability to buy and sell and to move one's wealth?
How I would contextualize your question, which is an excellent one, is how do we deal with the fact that governments and central banks can change the rules on us overnight? In other words, we're told, oh, well, this is stable and this is forever and this is a permanent system. And then, bang, you know, there's a bit of a crisis somewhere and then suddenly the rules are all changed overnight, right? And the rules are typically changed to protect the interests of those at the very top of the wealth power pyramid, and then the rest of us just have to deal with it and absorb the losses, right? So, for instance, in the last financial crisis, there was mark-to-market, which was a mechanism which created some discipline in the market because the actual market value was transparently found or identified every day, and then that was wiped out, and so banks could then make absurd claims as to the value of their assets, right? So, and that's never been restored. So instead of transparency, we have this sort of obscure system that protects banks. And tiny example, but there's many other examples, such as you mentioned in India, oh, well, that currency is going to expire and be worthless. So how do we deal with the potential for the rules changing overnight? And one of the ones that worries me and other people, too, is the possibility that your IRA money could, you know, some percentage of it or all of it could be transferred into government bonds under the guise of protecting us, quote unquote, from risky investments, right? So that's the kind of stuff that people are talking about, because we see that when crisis occurs, the governments can do a lot of wild and crazy stuff without really thinking through the unintended consequences of this, like, you know, eliminating all large cash bills. And I wanted to also mention, this is why cash is retaining its value, especially the U.S. currency. In other words, like as you said about Gresham's law, good, you know, bad money drives out good, right? And so what the U.S. currency, because it's considered generally trustworthy as a currency, it's good around the world. So in terms of, like, you know, you say good and bad currency, if you have a $100 bill in Laos or Bolivia or you know, Botswana, wherever you are, that is money, because everyone recognizes that's American currency, and it's going to be able to be converted into something else of value, or you can use it to buy goods and services. And the same can't be said of most of the other world's currencies. And so this is one of the reasons why I've been a bit of a, not if a dollar bull, in the sense that the dollar is likely to continue holding its value because every other currency is even more at risk of being devalued.
But the only problem is, ultimately, you know, even for the precious metals crowd, this will, you know, have very serious implications. But, I mean, there is just no easy way. Once, you know, they open up Pandora's box and they allow this easy money fiat system to take over, history has shown us what happens. But then we've never seen it on a global basis, which we have today. You know, maybe that would be a great place to wrap up today's discussion. When the music stops, this financial system, there'll be a day of reckoning. Tell us just what, you know, what might happen.
I would start by looking at what the trick that the global central banks have played for the last, you know, 8 years is to lower interest rates so that more people and companies and nations can borrow more money, but it costs them less because the interest rate is, instead of being 6%, it's 1% or 0.5%. And so this has enabled the music to go on, right? That this is the trick that's been kept the system afloat and allowed this enormous expansion, is the interest rates keep dropping. So if you can't sell a car, for example, at 7.9% interest, well, how about 1.9%? Well, that makes a huge difference in the monthly payment. You can sell a lot more cars at 1.9%. And the same is true of mortgages. And so, but now that whole trick is kind of run out of steam. There's diminishing returns on that. In other words, now interest rates are clicking higher because we've flooded the world economy with all this cheap credit. And so there's asset bubbles. Everything's rising in price. And so we're not going to be able to play that trick for another 8 years. And that's why we're talking about the music's going to stop and there's going to be some reset, is because this trick has run out of steam, right? You can't drop interest rates to negative 5% when inflation's running at 5%, right? I mean, your money is going to lose its value. So the question is, what are the central banks and central governments going to do to save the day? As we've been saying, they can't lower interest rates anymore. That's not going to fly. So what are they going to do? And so they can print money or create money digitally and send it to us all, you know, like the Federal Reserve could create $1 trillion with a keystroke and send us each $1,000 to help us pay our debts, right, to keep us afloat. But is that really a positive solution? It's just kind of like three-card Monty, right? The Federal Reserve is simply shifting the P and around the cups, right? We haven't really resolved the bad debt issue. Or you can destroy your currency and wipe everybody out. And so I'm not sure which strategy they're going to pick, but they both are not really solutions. They're just another trick to try to keep the thing afloat. And so it goes back to income, like productive assets that generated in whatever the reset is, whether they wipe out our currency or whether the debt system collapses and there's bank holidays and 90% depreciation of all financial assets, or however it's going to play out. The key for all of us as individuals and households is to make sure we own, without any debt, we own actual collateral, you know, stuff that has value regardless of the currency situation or regardless of the overall economy, because those assets will quickly find a correct market value after the reset, right? So I hope that answer isn't too convoluted, but one way or another, all the bad debt's going to be liquidated. It's going to be written down either directly or through a currency devaluation that wipes out everybody holding, you know, financial assets in currency. So, you know, you want to own an orchard. Guess what? No matter what happens to the currency, it's wiped out after the reset, and people still need to eat, and you can sell it, barter it, and so that's going to retain its value. So that's where I'm focusing is real collateral, real income streams, because that'll survive the reset.
Something with substance, something where you can crystallize the wealth that you've accumulated, if you've managed to even do so. You know, I mean, according to several bloggers and websites, not to mention St. Louis Fed, very few people in this country on a large scale basis can claim to have even $1,000 in savings were an emergency to emerge without having to use debt or turn to lenders. Makes one wonder whether or not we have the resources to even prepare as a society now, which maybe is a topic for another day. Why don't you tell people more about the services you provide, and more importantly, the must-read material that folks can find at the Of Two Minds website?
Well, thank you, Chris. I would invite everybody to take a look at first chapters of my book, A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All. That you can find on of2minds.com, my most recent major book. So that's kind of where my thinking is, and I invite you to read the free parts of the book and look at my extensive archives.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. It's been my pleasure.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation,
almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.